This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank. Focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
My French is a little rusty, but here's one translation of the name of the French bank BNP Paribas. Trouble, with a capital T. BNP said today it's been infected by the American subprime mess. Any guesses out there as to what Wall Street did next? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Duke University's Fuqua School of Business Executive MBA programs, where working professionals earn Duke MBAs from locations around the world. Online at DukeExecutiveMBA.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is the 9th of August, Thursday. Good to have you here. BNP Paribas has this great feature on its website where you can listen to an audio version of their press releases. The one from this morning is worth a special listen.
The complete evaporation of liquidity in certain market segments of the U.S. securitization market has made it impossible to value certain assets fairly regardless of their quality or credit rating.
I'll be honest with you, it almost doesn't matter if you understood all of that. All you had to get was the beginning, the complete evaporation of liquidity in certain markets. Certain markets, of course, would be this one, the squeeze in the U.S. credit market as a result of the subprime mortgage debacle. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is at the European desk in London. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
So we wake up this morning in this country, Stephen, and BNP Paribas has said something that obviously was greatly disturbing. What exactly happened?
The French bank suspended three of its investment funds worth around $2.5 billion. The funds had bought a big slice of the American subprime mortgages that have been parceled up and sold off to banks around the globe. Now, as we all know, a lot of these mortgages have gone bad. The homeowners are in default. So these mortgage-backed securities that BNP Paribas have bought look to be worthless. BNP Paribas is holding what is called in financial markets toxic waste.
The European Central Bank responded swiftly, I suppose it should be said. They pumped about $130 billion into the market, into the banking sector. Why?
Well, BNP Paribas is only the latest sign that credit markets are in trouble. Investors are getting a lot more nervous about buying up these parceled up loans, these securitized loans. So to ease the market, the ECB, the European Central Bank, it offered European banks at relatively modest rates of interest this sum of money. And 49 banks and other financial institutions said, yes, please. This is essentially the European Central Bank acting as the lender of last resort, making sure that credit doesn't dry out.
That $130 billion that the ECB let fly this morning, has it calmed things down? How are people reacting?
Yes, it seems to have brought a little bit of order, although it's also raised a number of questions. The primary one being, how serious is this? You have the optimists saying this will be turmoil in stock and bond markets for a few weeks and then it'll settle down. Pessimists say we could be seeing the start of something much more serious in the real economy. If banks grow ever more reluctant to lend because of the losses they've sustained, that could hit economic growth.
The U.S. markets, Stephen, as I'm sure you've seen the past 10 days, 2 weeks, have been volatile in the extreme, up and down 200 points in a day. Has the same thing been happening on European bourses?
Very much so. The European bourses have really been following the American market. The Dow ends down and the European markets open down. The Dow picks up and the European markets follow suit.
Give me a little globalization 101 here, Stephen. Obviously, U.S. banks and mortgage lenders are being affected by the subprime issue and the credit squeeze. Why now in Europe is it happening?
Well, this is, I think, the most fascinating aspect of this. It seems that what has happened is that American banks have very cleverly been shoveling large amounts of this low-grade material over onto this side of the Atlantic. What appears to have happened is this. In the low interest rate world that we've lived in over the past few years, banks and other financial institutions have been increasingly desperate to get higher yields, to get a bigger return for their money. That has attracted them to these, what turn out to be now very risky, American subprime mortgages.
Stephen Beard at the Marketplace European Desk in London. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Kai.
It wasn't only the European Central Bank that let extra capital into the markets. The Federal Reserve followed suit, an extra $24 billion to grease the wheels. The Treasury Department came out this afternoon and said it's monitoring the markets, too. Over at the White House, President Bush held a press conference this morning. The first question wasn't Iraq or the war on terror. He was asked about the bridge collapse in Minneapolis and whether he'd support higher gas taxes to fix the infrastructure, maybe a nickel a gallon. He didn't exactly say no, but he didn't leave much doubt about the answer either.
You know, it's an interesting question about how Congress spends and prioritizes highway money. My suggestion would be that they revisit the process by which they spend gasoline money in the first place.
It was, on balance, a pretty economics-heavy session on the topic of most interest to Wall Street, the credit crisis coming out of the housing market. The president was asked about remarks he made yesterday.
I talked about the different scenarios that I had been briefed on about whether or not there would be precipitous decline in housing or whether it would be what one would call a soft landing. And it appeared at this point in time that it looks we're headed for a soft landing. And that's what the facts say.
It's tough to say for sure if the president knew where the markets were as he was speaking. The Dow was off about 150 points at the time. But he also got a question about the news of the day out of France and what effect it was having on Wall Street.
Another factor one has got to look at is the amount of liquidity in the system. In other words, is there enough liquidity to enable markets to be able to correct? And I am told there is enough liquidity in the system to enable markets to correct.
And correct, those markets did today, down almost 3% each on the Dow and the S&P, more than 2% on the NASDAQ. We'll have more on the subprime mess coming up in just a minute and details from the markets when we do the numbers. We continue the subprime story with this thought. Falling markets aren't the end of the world. Savvy investors have always had a way to make their own silk purses out of a sow's ear. They bet against companies in trouble whose share price they think might fall. It's a practice known as short selling, and it's not for the faint of heart. If you bet wrong, you can lose more than you have, if that makes any sense. We bring this up today because some people have been shorting the companies that created and financed the subprime debacle. Marketplace's Steve Tripoli has been asking whether there's still time for a profitable bet against the architects of subprime.
Rich Gates has been short-selling subprime lenders since late last year. He's co-manager of the TFS Market Neutral Mutual Fund, and he's made bets against three lenders that have paid off.
They've been very profitable for us. This has been a segment of the market that's been absolutely hammered. Many of these securities are down over 50, 70, and even 90% for the year.
It's not just subprime lenders who were targets for short sellers. Plenty of other companies are caught up in this mess. Chuck Zender, co-manager of the Luthold Grizzly Short Fund, says it's easy to identify them by type.
Banks, insurance companies, credit companies, mortgage loan companies. The way I like to describe them are companies that deal in pieces of paper.
The problem is it's hard to value the packages of subprime mortgages these companies hold. That's because they're not publicly traded, like stocks. So no one knows what they're really worth at any moment until they're actually sold.
So in some instances, the insiders are saying the last thing they want is these things to trade because then they've got a price to mark them to where without that trade, it's still a theoretical price.
Zender says the big financial firms prefer to mask the extent of their subprime mortgage exposure. They don't want anyone to know how many bad loans they're holding or how they've been affected by the subprime debacle. But that makes it tough for investors to figure out how much these companies or their distressed securities are worth. Since they're flying blind, most will want to bid low. But that can trigger much bigger problems. Too many lowball bids can spook the markets. They can feed a downward spiral, which is one way financial panics start. Zender says we've seen it before in the 1997 Asian crisis and the Russian debt crisis that followed.
That's exactly what happened, is these people bid low, and sometimes the seller doesn't have any choice. The seller gets forced either by his lender or investors to sell, and then you create these panics in the marketplace when people see, oh my gosh, that was the price. What am I going to do now?
We're seeing some of that low-ball bidding in this market. But if you still want to try to make money shorting subprime players, you should know you have two strikes against you now. Venture capitalist Peter Cohen says the first is that it's late in the game.
It is not as good of a time to short as it was back in December. A lot of the bad news was not out in December, but it is out now.
And mutual fund manager Rich Gates says you should remember that shorting individual companies is extremely risky for individual investors.
So I think the best way for retail investors to participate in short selling is through a well-diversified portfolio of shorts and maybe through the use of a professional money manager.
Don't forget, shorting is about borrowing stocks in the hope of paying them back once those shares tank. But what if they don't tank? Borrowing to invest is a form of leverage. If the borrowed stock goes up after you bet against it, your losses can quickly snowball. That would be ironic. Excessive use of leverage is what got a lot of folks burned by subprime mortgages into so much trouble in the first place. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
Time now for a little marketplace game of free association. Here we go. Category is brand images. When you see a little red cross on a package, do you think of Band-Aids or disaster relief? The right answer might well be both, which is how this next story came to pass. Johnson & Johnson is suing the American Red Cross over the symbol they've shared for more than 100 years. Back in 1895, the Red Cross agreed not to use the symbol for commercial purposes, but J&J claims they've started doing just that. Jeremy Hobson reports.
In 2004, the American Red Cross started allowing companies to sell products stamped with a Red Cross, products ranging from emergency kits to nail clippers. The organization gets a share of the revenue, and Johnson & Johnson, which holds a trademark on the Red Cross design, has a problem with that. Here's J&J attorney John Cressan.
It leads to confusion in the marketplace, people thinking they're buying Johnson & Johnson branded products, and actually they're not.
So Johnson & Johnson wants all the Red Cross products taken off the shelves and destroyed, and all the proceeds from the ones that have already been sold, a number that totals less than $5 million, according to the Red Cross, which says those profits currently go to disaster relief and general operations. Red Cross spokesman Carrie Martin says she's astonished by the lawsuit.
We've had a long history, and we believe that these consumer products that we're creating need to get into the hands of Americans so they can be better prepared.
So who's right? Trademark law expert Michael Frumkin at the University of Miami says Johnson & Johnson has a pretty good case.
I mean, it seems really weird to be defending, you know, the multi-billion-dollar conglomerate against the nice guys of the Red Cross. But again, if what's in the complaint is true, they've got a point.
Frumkin says Johnson & Johnson had no choice but to act.
With trademark law, if you let the camel's nose get under the tent, pretty soon you don't even own the tent anymore.
Johnson & Johnson won't say whether it's lost any business as a result of the Red Cross ruckus, but it's worth noting the company made more than $3 billion last quarter. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
It's always a little surprising when the news brings you a tidbit of information you didn't have, like the fact that Campbell, the soup company, owns Godiva Chocolates. As it happens, Campbell also owns Pepperidge Farm and V8, the vegetable juice, but the company's decided Godiva is a little too indulgent for the Campbell image. It's focused on healthy foods now, executives said today. And sinful Belgian-style chocolates just don't fit that brand image, so Godiva's for sale, Ashley Miltite reports.
Campbell may be foregoing the sweet taste of Belgian chocolate, but critics say it's salt the company should really be worried about. Michael Jacobson is executive director of the Center for Science in the Public Interest.
When you talk about high-sodium foods, you inevitably talk about Campbell's soup. So they've been in the spotlight, and that has encouraged them to really make an investment in trying to do research to find out how to lower sodium.
Campbell has reduced the amount of salt in many of its soups and its V8 vegetable juice, so it's making a decent effort, says Jacobson. Still, it's got some way to go.
Their Pepperidge Farm breads, of course, have a fair amount of sodium. So it's not exactly a health food company. In fact, for something like chicken noodle soup, you practically need a microscope to find the chicken.
As for how well Godiva's been performing for Campbell, the company doesn't break out its numbers. Mitchell Corwin is an analyst for Morningstar. He says premium chocolate sales have been rising by double digits, but Campbell is making the right move by selling Godiva.
The business doesn't belong in its portfolio. There aren't any synergies between the Godiva brand and any of Campbell's larger brands, including its namesake brand and V8.
Corwin says Godiva could fetch more than $1 billion. He says there'll be plenty of buyers who are willing to cash in on consumers' growing taste for high-end chocolate. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Coming up, Venezuelans head north to set up shop.
We just came with another couple friends, and both of us, we bought houses here. We felt at home from the first minute.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial slumped 387 points today, 2.8% to close at 13,270. The NASDAQ fell 56 points, about 2.1% to finish at 2,556. The S&P 500 slid 44 points, just under 3% to end at 1,453. Financials felt the pain as worries about a credit squeeze took hold overseas. Banking giant Citigroup slid about 5.25%. Investors mauled down Bear Stearns 5.8% today. Home Depot dipped about 5.33%. The company said it might lower the $10 billion sale price of its supply unit to three private equity firms. Also, it's going to change its stock buyback amid worries about, wait for it, yes, the current financial market conditions. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Treasury Department releases the federal budget for July. Space Shuttle Endeavour is scheduled to dock with the International Space Station. And it's probably not a holiday you get to take off from work, but in some circles, August 10th is National Duran Duran Appreciation Day. Can't get enough 80s? I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This has been and is a tough summer for airline travel. Planes are crowded, delays are at record highs, and security lines seem only to be getting longer. The Department of Homeland Security came out today with a third edition of what's called Secure Flight. That's its passenger pre-screening program. Earlier versions had the government tapping into private consumer data, credit records, for example, by buying that information from commercial databases. A congressional study concluded the program couldn't ensure either privacy or accuracy, so today the government changed course. Marketplace's Bob Moon reports.
The airlines are currently responsible for checking passengers against terrorist watch lists. The new plan would transfer the task to the Transportation Security Administration. Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff confidently declared his reworked idea would not raise privacy concerns.
It's not going to rely on collecting commercial data. It's not going to assign a risk score to passengers. It's not going to try to predict behavior.
Soon after he issued that assurance, a leading privacy rights advocate fired back.
The only possible purpose for secure flight
is as a make-work scheme for contractors.
Bill Scannell speaks for the nonprofit Identity Project. He doesn't buy Chertoff's recommendation that passengers can clear security easier if they volunteer their gender and birth date when they buy their plane tickets.
The whole point here is to help us get a little bit of information about identification so we can differentiate the innocent passenger from the person with the same name who happens to be on a watch list.
Clearly, Michael Chertoff believes that Osama bin Laden is going to travel from Detroit under his own name, sitting in row 13E, eating a special meal.
Bill Scannell's organization ridicules the government's so-called secure flight program with a website called unsecureflight.com. He says Americans have a right to freely move about the country without having to present their papers, especially when being safe and sane doesn't require that.
Under the same security program, people are checked for weapons and explosives as they board the aircraft. Their luggage is checked for explosives and to make sure their cargo is safe. And then they're allowed to board the plane.
Homeland Security plans to finalize its program after a public comment period and implement the rules sometime next year. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Here we are in the second week of August, which means the first day of school will soon be upon us. For the nation's retailers, it can't come soon enough. Most of them posted weaker than expected July sales this morning. High gas prices get part of the blame. Also, sluggish sales of traditional back-to-school items. Parents procrastinating before shelling out for new clothes and supplies. Of course, retailers are trying everything to get us into stores, including gift cards and rebates. Commentator Ian Ayers points out they're banking on that aforementioned habit. Procrastination.
My kid's school has repeatedly hit us up to buy Stop and Shop gift cards to pay for our groceries. For every $100 card we buy, Stop and Shop gives the school $5. It sounds like a great deal, but nobody tells you the proportion of Stop and Shop cards that people forget to redeem. I bet it's a lot more than 5%. When TiVo offered 100,000 new subscribers a $100 rebate, nearly half of them failed to mail in the rebate. Bam! That's an extra $5 million in profits. The rates of redemption are often below 70%. Sellers make you clip, copy, and mail rebates because they want you to screw up. That means more than 30% of the time, the retailer gets to keep the money. So while my school's gift cards seem to raise money without costing parents anything, I view the fundraiser as bordering on the immoral. The school doesn't disclose the real risk. But this fundraiser is costing parents real money, and they don't even get to claim a charitable deduction. What's behind all this? Firms are just taking advantage of the fact that consumers underestimate the chance that they'll fail to use a gift card or send in the rebate. The next time someone hits you up for a gift card, you should ask them what proportion of people actually cash in the card. Or ask the computer salesman what the redemption rate is on the mail-in rebate. If sellers disclosed redemption rates, then consumers could decide whether it's worth the risk. Better yet, if a seller has legitimate reasons for offering a manufacturer's rebate, it should be willing to donate any unclaimed gift cards or rebates to charity, maybe even my kid's school.
Ian Ayers teaches at the Yale Law School and Yale School of Management. Send us your thoughts when you get a chance. Go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says Contact. There's a growing community of Latinos down in South Florida. They're upwardly mobile, wealthy, and well-educated. They've been forced to leave their country by a leftist leader. And they're not Cubans. Venezuelans disillusioned with the rule of Hugo Chavez have transformed several Florida cities. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gratch reports.
Business cards, letterheads, y envelopes.
Every Wednesday morning, the Latino business elite gather at Rick Case Honda, off I-75 in the town of Weston. They drink Venezuelan coffee, chat about their investments, and ignore several requests to simmer down. This Wednesday, more than 70 people show up. Gabriel Dardick's one of them.
I am a financial advisor with Prudential Financial.
Dardick left Caracas 7 years ago and moved to Weston, a suburb of Fort Lauderdale. This town of 70,000 feels like a country club. Giant palms and majestic oaks shroud its winding streets. The public jogging path is wide enough to accommodate a golf cart. It boasts two country clubs, several elite schools, and the lowest poverty rate in the U.S. for a city of its size. Dardick says it was love at first sight.
We just came with another couple friends, and both of us, we bought houses here. We felt at home from the first minute.
Thousands of other Venezuelans have been similarly enamored. That influx has earned the town a nearly 50% Hispanic population and a nickname.
Westonzuela. Weston equals Venezuela.
Weston is half a dozen Venezuelan bakeries and cafes. Arepas and fresh cheese are sold in gas stations. Even Venezuela's obsession with beauties survived the journey. The Cady Pulido Beauty School in Weston trains 120 girls as young as five. In 4 years, it already boasts a Miss Venezuela and a Miss Universe. Another Weston girl is a favorite in the current Miss Venezuela competition. But it's not the only clinic serving Venezuelan immigrants in South Florida. A half hour south, in the town of Doral, Ernesto Ackerman helps run a low-cost medical clinic for struggling Venezuelans.
There is a guy that sells cheese, and he had a very bad thrombosis. He was almost dead. He was helped here, and he's alive and selling cheese, and it's the best cheese in town.
The clinic has no money. Ackerman and other board members spend $500 a month to keep the place going. He says the class divisions that so deeply divide Venezuelans back home also split Venezuelan Americans here.
People knows that this clinic is struggling, but we don't get help.
Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has branded these immigrants oligarchs. Carlos Fernandez was once Venezuela's largest distributor of cement and president of the National Chamber of Commerce. Then he helped organize a two-month general strike against Chavez in 2002. Now Fernandez lives in Weston, awaiting a verdict on his asylum petition. He says he lost a construction empire worth $5 million.
Today, I feel minimized, isolated, like I have lost the society that once surrounded me. I started at the bottom and climbed to the top. Now, I'm back to the bottom.
Fernandez sits at a Don Pan, a Venezuelan bakery chain with a store in Weston. Smooth jazz plays over the loudspeakers, and CNN is on the TV. Don Pan's owner, Manuel Oliver, admits it's a compromise to attract more non-Hispanic customers. You can't escape change here, he says, any more than you can in Venezuela. In Weston, I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Dan had his camera with him when he was out reporting that story for us. The pictures are on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, a tiny piece of American fashion is heading to the Middle East, in a manner of speaking. Barney's is set to be bought by a private equity firm owned by the government of Dubai. A Japanese competitor dropped out of the bidding war today. Istitmar, that's the Dubai group, if I'm pronouncing it right, has offered more than $942 million to take the retail chain off the hands of Jones Apparel. Jones bought Barney's for around $400 million back in 2004. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. On a day the Dow tumbled 387 points, 2.8%. BNP Paribas is another way to say that. The Nasdaq fell 56 points, 2.1%. The S&P 500 slid 44 points, just under 3% there. Our editors include John Buckley, Patty Hirsch, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, and Lisa Tucker. Next time on the program, it crunches, it crashes, its wheels are taller than you.
And that's what the fans come to see. They want to see this truck. I mean, it's 110% kick-ass. That's all it is to it.
Oh, man. Europe's got a case of monster truck fever. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.